Hi Mark, how's it going?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, Dan. Really, thanks for inviting me on.
And, thanks for coming on. Thanks for coming on.
A good chat with you.
Great. Do you want to just, I've known you for a number of years though, so I don't know if you want to give a quick intro and then we can dive back to birth. Go as far back as you want, really. But yeah, if you want to give a bit of an overview about you.
I'm Mark, obviously, Commercial Director of Sampling Innovations. We're a UK-based company supplying, as our name suggests, samples mainly to the beauty industry, fragrance, toiletries, cosmetics, with our own factory based in Spain, just outside of Barcelona, but also with an extended network of supply partners that enables us to offer quite a wide range of different sampling formats and technologies that allow us to work as a consultant, if you like, with brands rather than being driven by just producing sachets or vials or mini sort of samples. We try to work with brands to help them use samples for maximum benefit to promote their brand. And what's been fascinating for us over the last 10 years is, whereas historically everything we did was a free giveaway sample, increasing trend to be more targeted and selling samples or putting together innovative retail products, whether it be unit dose or sort of travel kits and collections, those sort of things.
Yeah, and then you've obviously got the sustainability piece, which is massive at the minute. But I'm personally super interested in that anyway. But if you could just take us then back to that, ended up, how did you begin and where did you end up? How did you end up at Sampling Innovations? And then
it's very much a family story. So my father, Derek, originally founded sort of Sampling Innovations as a concept.
Okay.
And his background was as a printer, an American printer, and he was their European sales director. And one product in their range was what's referred to as a scent strip or fragrance strip. You may have seen these in magazines, a piece of paper that's got a fold at one edge, which you'd open up and that would release the perfume. And he founded the company back in the 80s. Because he loved selling that product in particular, and meeting lots of people at Chanel and L'Oreal and so on. But he got frustrated that when they didn't want to, a scent strip, he wouldn't work with them for, say, a year or two or three until that was the sampling format they wanted to work with again. Because in the meantime, they might have wanted vials, they might have done a perfume sachet or not even promoting perfume at all. They might be focusing on skincare products or what have you. So he came up with the idea in the late 1980s that it would be great to have a company that could help brands on a sampling point of view, and managed to renegotiate his contract to still represent this Webcraft, their name was, represent this American scent strip supplier in Europe, but also then develop partnership with factories that could do sachets and vials, and Sampling Innovations was born. That's how the company was born. How did I get involved? Obviously,
how old were you at that point? You'd have been what, 8 or 9 or something like that?
I was 10 years old, I guess, when the company was born.
I clearly thought at 10, that's for me.
not quite. In fact, the office. I was obviously, admired my dad for going out on a limb and starting up his own company, and I remember some of the kind of the roller coasters in the first couple of years and the sort of the stresses and strains they seem to be under of sorts. I always wanted to get into business, if that makes sense. So, at school, sort of business studies, A-level, and that was always, I always thought I was going to be an entrepreneur and be a billionaire and invent the next best thing or what have you. And so after school, when I went to university, did a management science business type.
Oh, cool. What uni did you go to, Mark?
I went to Loughborough University.
Oh, cool. That was my biggest regret, actually, myself. I was big into sport then, not so much business at all. And I got an offer at Loughborough and then turned it down to remain in Canterbury because of a relationship, which is very important when you're 18, like the be all and end all. So should have gone to Loughborough myself. But
my biggest regret is that I went to Loughborough because, again, absolute love of sport, which it's obviously famous for.
Yeah,
you have to be exceedingly good if you're actually going to sort of play and represent the university. Even like fourth team football was like county standard players.
Yeah,
sort of type thing. So although you're immersed and surrounded by sport, probably in my entire life, the least amount of sport I've physically played in a organised team environment was in my years at Loughborough. But
that's nuts, isn't it?
But full of enthusiasm, but lacking in real raw talent, sadly. So, sort of like a fouling, tackling, defensive midfielder didn't quite bust.
Yeah. That was my kind of role as well, actually.
There you go. Yeah. kind of bringing it back to the business sort of side. Yeah, so having progressed through Loughborough, management science degree, did a year's placement, which is one of the other things that attracted me to Loughborough, actually, because as part of that business degree, you had to do a year in work as part of that, and got placed at Vauxhall Motors.
Oh, cool.
Of all places in Luton, did a year sort of in their marketing department, and then marketing was very much sort of the area that really sort of captured my imagination.
And had that captured your imagination before you went to Vauxhall, or it was your time at Vauxhall that?
Probably, yeah. So yeah, again, through sort of business studies, A level and degree, and I guess sampling innovations was sort of within the very much in the marketing sort of world. So hearing some of the stories my dad would be talking about in terms of what he might be doing with various brands or what have you. Yeah, I was definitely always interested in sort of like the marketing side. So indeed, you know, my first job was at a marketing agency, in Perspectives, as they were known then. These agencies get sort of bought up and rebranded every few years, it seems. So sadly, Perspectives in its original form is no longer exists. But yeah, that was a below the line promotional marketing agency, part of the huge WPP group, got involved in that initially on a helping their new business department pitch to potential new brands before moving on to the Orange phone account, coming up with ideas to, if you sign up to an Orange contract phone, you get a free stereo or a CD or
right, okay,
pounds off, or all these sort of promotional sort of gimmicks to encourage people to sign up to a phone contract. And then in early 2000,
I want people like you to blame them for all these alarm clocks and stuff that I've got.
Exactly,
they were always the incentives, weren't they?
Explainability later, yeah, but some of the stuff that we promoted and brought over and had been produced in the Far East or whatever would shudder, I think.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so that was my background, and then in the
was that straight out of uni, Mark? So were you like 22 then, 23?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I was at Perspectives for 3.5 years, I think it was, before my father and my brother, who was involved in the business at that point, that Sampling Innovations was growing and doing really well at a time when my dad was now starting to want to take a bit more of a back seat and had fallen in love with the game of golf and so forth. And they knew actually that I'd just started to become a little frustrated at the agency I was working at, because they'd been bought out by a big conglomerate company, kind of the atmosphere in the office, you know, very much changed, because it wasn't as much, wasn't so fun as it had been. I'd started to look to inquire about, you know, and had a couple of interviews with some other sort of central London agencies to move and progress my career. And at that point, my dad and my brother sort of approached me to say, you know, look, we're growing. We definitely need someone on the commercial sales side of the business. You've developed some interesting sort of marketing contacts, etc. Would you be interested in coming on board? And after a bit of thought and concern about working with my brother primarily.
Oh, really? Is he older?
He's 3 years old, and we've always been very competitive with one another.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, it worked. So yeah, we came on board, and we were very different personalities. So you know, I very much sort of grew into the kind of the sales side of the business, and my brother was very much suited to kind of managing supply chain, operational sort of side of the business.
Yeah.
Bit more eye for detail, perhaps. And
are you saying that salespeople don't have an eye for detail?
Without trying to stereotype too much, wasn't far from the truth. That yeah, we were a pretty good partnership for a few years, so that's how I got involved in the business.
Wow. So that was mid-20s.
That was early. So 2002 was when I first joined it.
And like the first 6 months, were you loving it, or did you have any regrets, or what were the struggles like working?
What I loved from day one was the diversity of the industry that we work in, and because we specialised in the beauty industry, it could be a meeting at Boots head office or Beiersdorf head office, and you know all the sort of the grandeur that seemed to be for me at that point, or it could be in a, you know, around a kitchen sink at someone's West London flat or what have you.
Yeah,
talking about a complete startup wanting, you know, 1,000 samples of something and having to try and explain to them that, you know, commercially need sort of like 5,000-10,000 sort of units to make it work. So I've loved that from day one, is meeting people, being involved in understanding, seeing how brands come to be of literally all shapes and sizes, from that, you know, that startup dream through to, you know, huge global sort of corporations, and not knowing, you know, where I'm going to be from one day to the next. So that's I fell in love with that from day one.
And did you think you were going to remain when you joined it, like the family business? Did you always think like, this is going to be, I'm here for the duration now, or do you plan thinking actually it's been a few years? Or
I don't know, and it's interesting, you know, my brother's no longer involved in the business, because after sort of 10, 15 years, he felt he needed a new, you know, it just became, I guess, too all consuming.
Yeah.
Just after the sort of the financial sort of crisis, et cetera, which put some stresses and strains on the, so this is like, 2008, 2009 was a really tricky period for us. And it became a huge challenge for him and for us as a family, you know, put a lot of stress on us as a family at that point. And to be fair to Keith, you know, he was able to take some time out, reevaluate what he really wanted out of life, and now he's literally just started up his own brand over the last 12 months. He was working for Nouveau Lash, which is a very large beauty brand. He's always loved travel, so he was like there managing their sales, international sales. He was going around to all sorts of different.
Oh, so he went from the ops side supply chain into sales.
He did, yeah.
Okay, why he left. Really, he was just looking on at you with envy, thinking you've got my job that I wanted.
he moved over to that side, and has now launched. With some partners, his own brand, and you know, he's going down a completely different route, and doing really well, I think. The family business sort of side of things throws up all sorts of pros and cons, I would say, and it's for some people, I think it works, you know, incredibly well, and certainly for me. I think I've really benefited from that, and really enjoyed it, and ultimately taking on responsibility for taking on the company, albeit now in partnership with our own factory that we have in Spain. So back in those early days, it was literally just pure sales and marketing and an office, and everything was through supplier partnerships, and we were just logistically managing everything. During those difficult years, 2007 to 2010, we completely needed to change our business model and our approach, and at the same time had been approached by a guy, which is my business partner now, Jordi Caldouche, who came from a contract manufacturing background of sachets, wanting to develop a very similar concept to our business within the Spanish market, and approached us to say, you know, could he use the Sampling Innovations name and sort of create a franchise, if you like, of Sampling Innovations in the Spanish market. So we went through that process literally just prior to the sort of the financial crisis and crash back in sort of 2007, 2008, and where it was an amalgamation of different things. So on the one hand, opened up a sort of a satellite operation using our existing supply chain with Jordi in Spain. Two, there was then a huge financial crisis. And three, global purchasing and market dynamics were really changing. So what we were having in the UK was increasing success with smaller, medium-sized brands who there was a lot of innovation, lots of enthusiasm, lots of really exciting new brands coming through, and or wanted more targeted sampling activity. So we were getting a lot of demand, a lot of interest, a lot of requests for all sorts of different projects, but typically at smaller quantities and yeah. or needed it more urgently because they didn't have a 3-year development program to launch. Yeah. They wanted something weeks or what have you. And at that time, you know, we were working with Unilever and L'Oreal and P&G and Beiersdorf and these guys who, you know, wanted at least 1 million, if not 10 million of something. And our supply chain was a bit disjointed at a time when you had a lot of globalized purchasing. Sachets were almost becoming like a commodity type item. Yeah. The supply chain we had at that time, based on their MOQs, their lead times, their flexibility, just wasn't really particularly well aligned for one side of our business, which was, you know, growing phenomenally, but we weren't able to take as much advantage of that as we clearly needed to. And from a UK perspective, those global brands. Responsibility purchasing was no longer within the UK. So, you know, L'Oreal's factory, which we used to do loads of shampoo sachets for in Llantrisson in Wales, yeah. they no longer had the local ability to purchase. It had to go through sort of central sort of Paris.
Right, okay, yeah.
Purchasing sort of, P&G, you know, although we worked with them for many years, so again, supplying sort of sachets through globalized purchasing out of Geneva, you know, we eventually lost that sort of global, that contract, et cetera. So a real divergence of the two. So then as a consequence of that, you know, by now me and my brother were heavily involved in the running of the day-to-day sort of running of the company. You know, a real passionate believer that we really needed to change our supply chain model in order to focus more on these sort of smaller medium-sized brands and these sort of growing brands. Yeah. And the relationship with Jordi was crucial in that because for completely different reasons, he was having the same challenges in Spain in that because he was a brand new startup company, he had to have sort of, you know, he was opening doors again with smaller brands, but they wanted again, you know, 5,000, 10,000, maybe 25,000 samples, not 2 million, 5 million, 10 million. So he was also, although opening lots of doors at the concept and the range of products, was struggling to nail actually getting orders because either the lead time was too long or the MOQs were too high or, yeah. or the costs were too high at those MOQs. And with his contract manufacturing background, having run a successful sachet filling company in Spain, he then started for a couple of core products, sachets initially and later on vials, set up his own little micro sort of factory to be able to respond to those smaller inquiries. Yeah,
that makes sense.
And that grew up. And then 2013, we then went into total partnership together
That was like 5 years in the making almost. So you really cemented your relationship and got to know each other. It wasn't like a, oh, let's try and look for one. It was organic.
It was organic, and it was also complicated by different contracts and supply partners that we had at that time. For sachets, for vials, and for kind of scented label type products. From the UK perspective, we had very long established sort of contractual relationships with some of these sort of supply partners, whereas Jordi from Spain had a more flexible agreement with some of those sort of supply partners. So we had to go, it took us time to go from where we were to be able to be completely free to work with Jordi in across many of the different, some of the different formats that we were offering to the market. So there was a transitional period, which was a bit of a juggling act and certainly a challenge, but has been absolutely crucial to where we are now in being able to offer the great range of products that we have, but to all kinds of different brands and interestingly has actually really worked in our favor, because even the big global guys, partly because of sustainability, partly because of more analysis of the marketing budgets, etc., partly because of and the internet and more educated consumers, etc., are much more targeted in the sampling activity that they do. And rather than it, 10, 15 years ago, it would be about one product launch and get as many samples out of that one product. Now it's more about, the brand, the story, the range of products.
Yeah, it's much better.
Online, being able to try all of their products, etc. So even the bigger guys are more looking for smaller individual runs, but in fairness, lots of them across lots of different different products, rather than just one big run. So that change in the top line concept of the business has never changed, but the underlying supply chain that enabled us to deliver the range of products that we do at smaller quantities and a quicker, faster, more flexible approach has been fantastic. And since 2013, when that all got 100% sort of settled and finalized, it's been fantastic right through to where we are today.
And is there any other family involved at all now, or is it just you and
my wife and my brother-in-law are both involved in that?
Oh right, oh, okay.
So my dad, although he's retired, very much takes an active interest in what we're up to and what we're doing. So he's sort of like he's president, if you like, of the, of the corporation.
Does that help you though as a bit of a sounding board?
Yeah, very much so. That's been fantastic for me. Yeah. So when Jordi and Gary that's involved with me from a financial point of view in the UK. They're my sort of day-to-day sort of directorship team, if you like. Nothing beats having a round of golf with my dad, or when we're allowed, a barbecue or a pint or whatever, chatting over some of the stresses and challenges. And
well, I think it's important, isn't it? We've got a really close senior management team. There's like, fortunately, no family involved for me. But there's about, I think it's 10 of us. And it's great. And we always kick stuff around. We'd have all made terrible decisions if we were just doing it in isolation. But we use it now a couple of times a week, and it's great. But sometimes with Mark and Bob, who are these big shareholders in the business, they're a bit more removed. Just picking up the phone to them sometimes just to kick stuff around, because they're not blinkered, into the day in, day out stuff. And I think it really helps, especially because your dad knows the business as well.
I think experience is really important as well, because we get caught up in what's happening today and maybe over the last couple of years. But, some of the stories my dad will tell me that he was dealing with 20, 25 years ago or have you. And it's just the world has sort of turned around, and 20 years later dealing with the same challenge.
It's normally people. They're the biggest challenges. But
yeah, no doubt about it.
Yeah, that doesn't change, does it? And what with Geordie, what are the challenges with working closely with someone in another country? I know it's not far away with Zoom and stuff like that now. It must
Yeah,
be.
I mean, certainly it's been there's there are undoubtedly cultural differences, which is both hugely interesting and enjoyable on the one hand, and at other times, deeply sort of frustrating and challenging. But yeah, no, Geordie and I have a great relationship. It's I haven't been over to the factory now since I think it was February last year that I was there. It
Crazy, isn't it?
every 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah.
I'd have been there and enjoying some tapas and a glass of Rioja or what have you.
Yeah,
So
absolutely.
I've missed terribly. But yeah, no, Zoom generation, etc., shows you what you can achieve. 95% perhaps of what you would have done, and
Not the same, though, is it?
without taking 2 days out of the office, frankly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's been a fascinating experience over the last throughout these lockdowns for sure.
Yeah, crazy. But you're both as partners, you're both very aligned on what you want to do.
Yeah,
And
totally. So,
oh, by the way, does Geordie, is he as keen to come over here as you are to go over to Spain, or is it not?
less so, funnily enough, but they do.
Yeah, I thought that might be.
No, he does.
Yeah.
He definitely enjoys coming over. London and Brighton and
Yeah.
etc. There's obviously a lot of interesting things like the royal family and the English pub and a.
Yeah.
And an English breakfast he particularly loves and enjoys, etc. So yeah, no, he's although the weather's an issue without a shadow of a doubt, so he'll tend to visit more in the summer months than getting him over here in sort of December, January, February can be a challenge. But yeah, no,
Yeah,
he does enjoy traveling as well.
I'll have to come and have a look at the factory in Spain with you another time when it opens
He's
up.
more than welcome to.
I like tapas and Rioja, so that's a winner. When you
Well,
were talking about the smaller customers, so what is the MOQs that you're for you guys?
very slightly depending on product, but yeah, probably in most cases we can work with an MOQ of sort of 5,000 samples, which may sound still quite high in some sort of worlds. But when we're talking about sampling, which is all about exposing people to a new brand or a new product, 5,000 really is absolutely nothing. It's amazing how often I've spoken with sort of startup brands or what have you, convinced them to start with 5, or to be honest with you, 10,000 is often where we end up at, because commercially speaking, almost for the same total cost, you can have 10,000 samples instead of having the minimum of 5,000 samples.
Yeah.
So
And do the customers supply you with a liquid for those samples?
Variety of options. So normally, yeah, we provide full service apart from the brand will free issue the liquid formula
Okay.
from excellent guys such as yourself, Dan.
Of
But
course.
as part of our service, we often, and particularly we'll come on to Brexit, I'm sure, shortly, and the challenges that poses. But for years, we've often arranged to collect the bulk product and get that over to our factory. So often it's free issued, but we'll arrange the collection and logistics of getting that to our factory, etc. And because of the growth in the retail sales product side of our business, it's not uncommon for us to even buy the bulk product
Oh, okay.
from contract manufacturing partners. So yeah, the brand will tell us, who it is that's the approved supplier of their product, and we'll often. As I say, mainly for the retail sales side, but even just from a logistics point of view and responsibility point of view, we often actually buy the bulk from a brand's approved contract partner.
Yeah, I won't ask you, I won't say who'd you prefer dealing with, retailers or brands, because if the retailers listen, they'll be very disappointed. But
It's not about who you prefer, but I think nothing beats speaking directly to a brand owner or a
yeah.
founder. Yeah, that just the passion and the interest that develops, and I'm sure retailers will understand and recognize this. Quick decisions and instant decisions. It's much easier for a brand owner to do that. Obviously the bigger retailers have a much bigger chain of responsibility and so forth, and so it can be a challenge achieving some of the timings when the approval processes sort of take so long, etc.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We were talking a bit before, weren't we, as well, about the relationships, and when you work with the founders, you know that if you work with those, you're likely to be working with them for 5 or 10 years, and you've got these long-term. Yeah. Whereas with retailers, it's slightly different. You've got the buyers for the certain categories, and they're definitely not in those roles for as long as they used to be. That's for
sure. It's a challenge, isn't it? Yeah, you know, but as a supplier to those guys, you know, just as you build up a good relationship, and you've got a great sort of concept for the next sort of year or so, they change roles. Yeah. And it's all, you know, in some cases, it really is starting all over again. So it can be a little bit soul-destroyed at times, definitely.
Yeah, I'm sure that's by design by the retailer, but it's so frustrating for anyone supplying in, isn't it? And I'm sure there's, like, benefits for them. But
yeah. And the flip side, you know, those brand owners, without a shadow of a doubt, the most enjoyment I've got out of being involved in this business and this industry is those startup brands that then, you know, really go on to something great, and being a little small part of that success journey. So, you know, so for us, you know, we're working with Lizelle from, you know, when they were all based on the Isle of Wight, and selling on sort of QVC and doing the first little few samples for them.
No, they are QVC.
Their growth, you know, Charlotte Tilbury again, from doing 10,000 sachets of foundation to, you know, hundreds of thousands of every single product in their range, has been, you know, phenomenal, and until they've been bought out by Pooch. Trini's a brand currently that's, you know, just sort of going from, you know, small starting point to absolute sort of gangbusters, etc. So I absolutely love that side of it, you know, from a little small idea and but with grand plans, and being able to challenge the status quo and really sort of cut through and create an impact in the market.
It's ace, isn't it? I always compare it with, like, BrewDog just disrupting that sector with Carlsberg and Tetley's. Like, that's exciting. Yeah. It's opening up the door for all these other people. Yeah, it's one of the reasons we reduced our MOQs down to really help out these startups and give them a foot in. So
yeah, absolutely.
And then they're the ones that you get the relationships with. They're the ones that then you want to go the extra mile for, because they're just all about the relationship as well, and you want to help them out. Like you were saying that earlier, and it was just
absolutely, yeah, that kind of consultancy, business partnership, trust, respect.
Yeah, that's it. It is the partnership, trust, and respect. It's like,
yeah, that's what I really, really love. You know, people that will ask us questions and ask for our sort of advice and thoughts, and I absolutely love that, and developing those together and changing the brief to something that's going to be bigger and better and have more impact for them is why I absolutely love. So whilst we do get, you know, inquiries, we definitely want 100,000 vials, and, you know, what price, and, you know, we have to be competitive, and we often are, but it's difficult to get.
It's transactional though, isn't it? It's like no added value.
It's almost like a commodity, and yeah, it's difficult to get overly excited about that, albeit obviously we're happy to do it.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Ensures that my kids have a house. But there's no doubt that when you get involved in those brands that want your advice, want your support, that you can sort of help and then see the success of that's absolutely brilliant.
And then sustainability is really important at the moment to these. How are you finding that with the sampling side?
It's a real challenge, because I think there's such a lack of clarity in the world about what really is the end game, what is the really solution. And there's a lot of sort of greenwashing and challenges in the middle, and a lot of mixed views, a lot of vested interest in some sectors that. But it is something I find absolutely fascinating, and it's absolutely clear that everybody has to be involved in a better future. So, you know, it's a huge part in our business now. You know, every single, or at least, you know, 95 out of 100 inquiries that we would have, you know, it's great to see that brands are, every single brand and retailer without question would at least ask the question, you know, is that, what's the material, what's the is there a more sustainable option, etc. We need we commercials still get involved in that side of it. And you know, some you know, there's still a lot of R&D work to be done to overcome some of the compatibility challenges, which is the crucial thing within the beauty sector, at least, to offer some better solutions. But there's been some really groundbreaking sort of developments. And there's different layers to this when we talk to brands about being more sort of sustainable and conscious. So from a materials point of view, a lot of development, you know, and there's different formats that offer different sort of characteristics. So yeah, we do glass vials, we do mini tubes from sugar cane. We can supply sachets with mono material that are in theory recyclable without aluminium foil in, etc. But it comes back to, you know, what is the formula? What's the formulation? How long do you need the samples to last? Because some of them do come with compatibility compromises.
Yeah.
Which has actually created interesting discussion around the industry has always relied on a 12-week, three-year shelf life. From a sample, and in your world and the retail world, totally understand why that's the case. From a sampling point of view, why does a brand want an unopened sample in the market for 3 years?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. But it's up to 3 years, I guess, isn't it? But yeah, no.
It's almost a waste of market. You know, you absolutely want people to, the whole purpose of the sampling is to get it into people's hands,
get them to use it,
open and try the product, and then hopefully go and buy it. Go and buy it in store or online as soon as possible would be the main aim. So, you know, whilst there undoubtedly is some compromise on compatibility, you know, we can print and emboss sort of batch codes, expiry dates. We can, you know, because MOQs are sort of much lower these days. Maybe it's about doing, you know, even more sort of smaller runs, etc. And then the side of things that I think is sometimes being overlooked, because everybody is desperate to be able to put the kind of the recyclable sort of claim on the,
yeah,
on the, but is possibly missing the bigger picture and the most important point, which is targeting samples so they're not a waste of time in terms of what ends up in the with the consumer. So what I mean by that is, you know, does the consumer really want that sample? Are they really your target audience that's going to realistically be interested in buying the product? So I think some of the distribution mechanics that have been used historically, you know, mass direct mail campaigns, loads of sachets in magazines, things being thrown out at train stations to anybody that walks past, different events, etc. I think maybe a bit more focus on accuracy of targeting, you know, possibly charging people a nominal fee for the sample that isn't going to put them off from wanting to do it, but they will need to have some level of interest.
Yeah, almost like a try before you buy to the certain community that they're targeting. That makes sense, because that's sustainable. The bigger picture, we don't want people buying, although it's a sale, I guess, if you wanted to be really hardcore about it, but no one wants people to be buying a 200ml jar or something, using it once, not liking it, and throwing it away. That's what you were saying, isn't it?
It's exactly, like, yeah. So I think sampling has a real role to play in helping reduce purchase of product that after one use, it's something they don't want, and sadly, you know, isn't given to a friend or someone who might like that. You know, in reality, that'll get thrown in the bin, and the waste that causes is a disaster. So I think, you know, responsible sampling has a real role to play, almost irrespective of what the packaging specification might be of that sample. Although, of course, there's a variety of different options in materials and format and so forth as well to help further. But yeah, I definitely think there's a lot of, at the moment, there's a lot of, it's plastic that's the issue, and in some cases that's not fair in the context of, you know, plastic is what gives a better shelf life, perhaps. It gives the flexibility, it protects the product, and it can come from sustainable sources. It can, you know, it could be PCR content that's from recycled, and, you know, possibly glass, which is heavy, which uses all sorts of transportation, CO2 issues, etc. You know, will it definitely get recycled? Who really knows? Is it definitely providing the better solution? In some cases, maybe, and yes, but I think, you know, you need to be open-minded to all sort of different options that are available. And whilst it's a minefield, and, you know, not only relies on the brand and therefore the supply chain of that brand, you know, the retailer, the government, your local council facilities, and of course the consumer, everybody needs to be involved in that process to deliver a more sustainable future.
I definitely agree. There's not one clear route, is there? And everything has to be considered. I suppose ultimately it's providing the brands that you're working with have a clear idea of what sustainability is for them, and they're doing everything for the right reason to hit their values and to hit their ethos.
Yeah.
That's kind of it, isn't it? And then everyone else around them can make sure it fits in there. That's why we're trying to do a lot of stuff from a sustainable, from environmental. And I suppose even the minimum order quantities, going back to what you were saying about the shelf life, no one wants anything hanging around for 3 years.
Yeah.
In some instances, these smaller brands that we both said we like dealing with, they've been having to buy 5,000 units or 10,000 units. And the sad thing with that is if it does hit the end of their shelf life, I mean, you could get it retested, but some people then have to dispose of it, and it can go to landfill, or it goes to a charity, but then there's a bit resident about it. So by reducing the MOQs down to 2,500, hopefully there's less of that. I suppose that's a sustainable tick as well, isn't it? But
yeah, definitely.
So much stuff to consider, the circular economy and all that kind of stuff. But
it is a real challenge. And what you obviously have lots of very vocal voices in one element of that complete circle, and you know, sadly I think there's just not enough control over the complete sort of bigger picture, and it isn't it's not something that there's just one, there's not one perfect solution. It does involve sort of everybody to reach a better future, definitely.
Well, it's when people started looking at the glass jars of coffee and doing refill pouches to reduce the weight in the glass, like you were talking about, and suddenly you're flying these pouches from the Far East to the UK. They're not recyclable, they're thrown away. So actually it probably makes sense just to keep it with a glass jar that people can reuse. And but you're constantly going around this merry-go-round. I think it's, but at least everyone's thinking about it and talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. That is undoubtedly, these things go in phases in terms of, you know, we have been through sort of eco phases previously, but then because of huge financial going back to financial crash or what have you, it's kind of come and gone a little bit in the past. But there's absolutely no doubt that now it's absolutely here to stay. You know, there's huge interest, there's huge buy-in now from, I think, everybody to develop better solutions. So I think it's an exciting time from a sort of a packaging technologist sort of point of view.
Absolutely,
there's real genuine R&D that's, you know, on all levels from all aspects of the industry and the supply chain. Everybody's really focused on this now, which is great.
Oh, I agree. And then the other challenge you mentioned or alluded to before was Brexit. So yeah. I won't dwell on it too much, but how are you finding that, especially with Spain?
It's been complicated, there's no doubt. And you do feel somewhat let down by the lack of clarity on what the rules and regulations really are. And, you know, despite all of the, are you prepared for Brexit? It was kind of like, you know, prepared for what exactly? Because there's no clarity on exactly what is going to happen and what the customs rules really are, etc. So, you know, it's been January was a challenge for sure, and it wasn't even about what's right or wrong from a paperwork regulatory point of view. It was literally down to who was the individual customs agent in in France or Spain or what have you, and what their interpretation of the rules and paperwork might be. So there was definitely a few teething sort of logistical issues. So yeah, January, February, and a bit of stress and strain associated with that. But thankfully, you know, we're fortunate that because we're sampling innovations in the UK and we're also sampling innovations in Spain, we've got both sides, if that makes sense.
Well, that does make sense.
We have a physical presence in Spain. So rather than exporting stuff as we've sort of historically done, now we're largely importing from Spain, if that makes sense. So yeah. We finally kind of large, and this does chop and change, which is what is frustrating. But yeah, we've kind of largely got our heads around the sort of paperwork requirements. There's a little bit more documentation that's required, and there's sort of an importation process in terms of we'll collect from yourselves, for instance, Dan, and we'll manage that importation to Spain rather than exporting it to Spain, if that makes sense.
Going back to what you were saying about supporting brands and I suppose you can, for the founders and stuff like that that are doing something similar, you can help them with the learnings and things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and indeed, you know, it's perhaps a different spin-off and something we're thinking about is because interesting, Spain is actually slightly there's Brexit and there's EU, but there's another layer with Spain whereby they treat cosmetics, because in Spain the cosmetics industry has largely grown up out of the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah. There's been lots of laboratories in the pharmaceutical world that have then launched a skincare line or what have you. The treatment of cosmetics in Spain is much closer to pharmaceutical products than it is in, say, France or Germany or Holland. So it's actually now very, very straightforward getting things into and out of some EU countries. But there's a slight another layer within Spain. So I know a lot of brands are really struggling shipping product to their distributors or sending direct to consumer in Spain, because it's simply not allowed unless you've got the right sort of regulatory sort of framework, etc. So interesting, a complete divergence to what we normally do, but because we have a facility and a reasonably sort of large warehouse and a lot of local contacts and connections, we're starting to think about, could we actually really help out a number of UK brands in terms of providing a sort of a, nice, either import and then getting it to their distribution partner, or possibly, you know, being involved in online sales, you know, could deliver product to our warehouse possibly, and then we'll help out with delivery to local consumers perhaps. So that's, we're very much in its infancy at the moment. We've only really just got our heads around how it infects.
If anyone's listening that needs support now, get in touch with Mark.
if there's brands out there that are desperate to try and get product to consumers in the Spanish marketplace, then I can't guarantee it at the moment, and it might not be right, and I might regret saying this.
But you'd have a chat with people.
We'll definitely have a chat about it. Yeah, it's an interesting sort of angle that I think we're quite. There's not a lot of places that have their business split between sort of Spain and the UK. So I think we're quite.
Yeah, maybe I need to look at a Spanish base. That would be nice.
You can certainly help, perhaps.
Yeah, awesome. Cheers, Mark. How do they get in touch with you if they want to speak to you?
Through our website, sampling-innovations.com, or email me directly. Fairly simple, mark@sampling-innovations.com. You can also go on to our website and see our contact details, telephone number, etc. So yeah, please do check us out, and if anyone's keen for being more impactful in, you know, if they either haven't ever sampled, would love to have a chat and just talk to about how sampling could really help your business, or if you do sampling but perhaps, you know, a little bit disappointed with some of the results you've been getting, or wondering if you could do it in a more sustainable way or more innovative way, then would love to think that, you know, we've got some solutions and some ideas and suggestions that will help you get a better return on investment from what budget you are spending on sampling. And then finally, you know, one of the things, you know, I absolutely love this kind of product that we do for Floral Street, which is a discovery set of vials, for instance. So, you know, these sort of kind of products, which are fabulous for sort of giftable occasions and for people, again, you know, kind of almost like responsible sampling. You know, if people want to try, it's very challenging at the moment to try fragrances in a store environment, and certainly, you know, you're not necessarily going to be able to try every fragrance in a range. So little kind of discovery sets, kits, collections, unit dose product for sale. There's a number of sort of innovative ideas that we can offer.
And can people see that on the website?
Yeah, there's lots of good.
Anyone listening to this podcast wouldn't have a clue what you just presented to me, other than the glass vials in the carton. So yeah, check it out. I'll put the video on YouTube. You can have a look. Awesome. Well, thanks for your time, Mark. I really like chatting to you.
Real pleasure, Dan. It's always always good talking to you too.
And I look forward to catching up with some tapas and rioja.
Let's sort that out. Awesome. It'd be wonderful to travel again and be able to enjoy that side of things there.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cheers. Thanks for your time, Mark. All the best.
Take care. Bye bye.